Italy has long been home to a magnificent variety of great foods and drinks, the kind that gets you in touch with the season and the lands around you. On today's Travel with Rick Steves, Fred Plotkin tips us off on less traveled places in Italy, where you can even indulge in some of the same kinds of treats the early Romans enjoyed, or the cheese that brought Michelangelo down from his scaffolding for a lunch break. And friends from Belgium tell us about the comfort foods of their youth. We'll see how tasty the real home of French fries can get and how far our taste buds have come over the years. Let's open the hour with a Veterans Day tribute to the men and women who protected the great art of Europe from being plundered or destroyed during the Second World War. Earlier this year in Chicago, the last of the original group of Allied troops known as the Monuments Men, Richard Baranchik, died at age 98. But the work at finding and repatriating missing treasures lives on. Robert Edsel started a foundation to recognize and continue their work. He joins us now to look at some of the places we can visit to honor their efforts. Robert, when you think about the Louvre Museum, what was it like before the Nazis took Paris, and then what was it like a couple years into the occupation?
Well, the Louvre's got several million objects in it today. At the time, it was 400,000 or 500,000 objects. But, you know, imagine 1939 going to visit the Louvre or any of the major museums throughout Europe. You could have rolled a bowling ball down the Grand Gallery of the Louvre and you would have hit nothing other than the empty frames leaning up against the wall, because the works of art, the paintings, the sculpture, coins, all the things in the collection had been evacuated to area chateaux, many of which were moved around on multiple occasions. The Mona Lisa was moved on 5 separate occasions during the war, trying to keep it out of harm's way, the initial concern being bombing and the fires that would follow, and then later, of course, theft by Adolf Hitler and the Nazis.
So just from a practical point of view, all of these precious canvases, and if you've walked on the Grand Gallery, it's like a hike, countless paintings. They left the frames. Did they just knife out the canvases, or did they take them apart very carefully, or what?
No, they took them apart. They had about, I mean, it's really extraordinary. I don't think it could be done today. They evacuated the Louvre in a period of 10 days. The local citizens volunteered, as took place in Italy and other countries, to help the curators there, because they just needed manpower, building crates, finding vehicles, fuel, etc. The frames they didn't take, not because they weren't valuable, they're hugely valuable, but they occupied more space in the crates. So the focus was on the actual canvases or panels taken out of their frames, packed in these crates, loaded up on the trucks, and then moved to areas where some of these things, very, very large, could be fit in. In the case of, say, the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam, the great painting by Rembrandt, Night Watch, a painting that measures maybe 10 feet tall by 18 feet across, is rolled up like a carpet because there was no way to move the thing to a place of safekeeping without rolling the canvas.
Now, I understand in the Louvre, for instance, there's actually, if you knew where to look, on the back of canvases, there'd be swastikas indicating that these were taken by Germans or wanted by Germans, or there's symbols on the paintings today that show which ones were brought back. Or what can you look for physically as a sort of memory of those difficult times?
Well, and without shamelessly plugging books, you in many cases have to find the books that talk about what's on the back, because you can't take the painting off the wall. That would probably get any of our visitors more attention than they'd ever want to have on one of these trips.
Yeah, okay.
But we do know that in the case at the Louvre, on the back of Vermeer's Astronomer, one of 2 Vermeers stolen by Hitler and the Nazis, there's a eagle swastika from the inventory. There's an inventory number on the back of Leonardo da Vinci's Lady with an Ermine at the Czartoryski Museum in Krakow, Poland. We located 3 paintings that were at the SMU Meadows Museum that had the Nazi inventory codes stamped on the back of those paintings. It appears they were properly restituted, but many of the paintings that were stolen by the Nazis, on the back, they put these inventory code numbers. In the case of the Rothschilds, you might see an R1171, which would mean the 1,171st item stolen from the Rothschild family, and there were inventory codes for each of the major families from whom these things were stolen. So it's an incredible undertaking, and it just goes to show, while a war's going on, the amount of diverted attention and manpower from fighting combat that was directed towards this looting operation.
Reading through monuments meant that struck me many times how much interest there was in art when people are bombing entire cities and untold thousands of people are being killed. Still, you had this parallel scramble going on for art. Was art used as rewards for military heroism or for collaborators?
Well, art was the kind of the weapon of propaganda by Hitler, trying to project to the German people this vision of what he saw as the master race. But it was also a major source of conferring attention on rewards for Nazi generals, rewards to Hitler. Early on in Hitler's leadership, many of the industrial leaders were encouraged to use funds to buy works of art that they knew Hitler or Goering or other Nazi party leaders wanted to have in their collections. So it's a major source of currency and a tremendous distraction during the war. I mean, you have Goering back to Paris making 22 separate visits to the Jeu de Paume Museum, where Rose Villain worked secretly underneath their nose, in as much as she understands German without their knowledge, to look at works of art that he wanted to steal for his own collection or for the Führer's collection. This all taking place while he's in charge of knocking England out of the war. It's really extraordinary.
Wouldn't the works of art in the Jeu de Paume have been what we call the degenerate art that Hitler didn't like?
Well, many of the works were degenerate paintings by Picasso, by Van Gogh, Monet, and others that the Nazis were removing from their own museums and trading and using sales proceeds to acquire works of art that they valued, in many cases the old master pictures. Of course, some of these degenerate works were ultimately destroyed, but the works that float through Jeu de Paume were whatever the great French collectors, many of whom were Jews, some of whom were dealers, the dealer collectors, had collected. And so it didn't just involve works of, say, the Western world, but some of the great tapestries of the world, some of the great Islamic works of the world, anything that was of value, that was a prized item for collecting. So many of these great collectors acquired them with very discriminating taste. And of course, it's one of the many paradoxes of this story that the Nazis would consider Jews subhuman and yet prize and respect their taste for what was acquired so much that they would try to be confiscating the things that they had in their own collections.
Or maybe just be pragmatic and say, well, it's not to my taste or my ideology, but it's worth a lot, and I'll take this degenerate piece of art here and this Jewish piece of art there and sell it and swap it for something that fits my style. Is that true?
I think that's true, and it's one of the reasons why I am so confident that so many of the things that are missing will someday surface, and it's why we try and get the word out to people that have any concern or question about something that maybe was brought home after the war, they acquired, that they don't know where the thing was during World War II, contact the Monuments Men Foundation and send us a photograph and let us be of assistance.
Robert M. Edsel is reminding us about the people who rescued Europe's greatest works of art and historical treasures from being looted or destroyed during World War II. He's with us in a previously unaired portion of our conversations with him on Travel with Rick Steves. Robert is the founder and chair of the Monuments Men and Women Foundation, originally called the Monuments Men Foundation for the Preservation of Art. He's written a number of books on the topic, including The Monuments Men, which George Clooney adapted into a movie in 2014. There's also a special exhibit about their work at the National World War II Museum in New Orleans. You'll find more at robertedsel.com. Robert, I would imagine you enjoy traveling Europe and just some sightseeing. Just for independent travelers that want to splice in a little bit of this Monuments Men history in their European travels, are there stops that are of particular interest in this topic?
Well, Rick, there are so many great places in Europe. Of course, Paris with the Louvre, the Jeu de Paume Museum, which everyone that walks through the Place de la Concorde walk by without knowing its pivotal role during the war. Berchtesgaden is a fantastically interesting place. It's horrific in some senses, the heart of Adolf Hitler's existence there in the Austrian Alps. It's beautiful up on top of Eagle's Nest, and you can walk through a remarkably well-designed visitor center to understand why that part of Austria was so important to Hitler. There are smaller places along the way, a cemetery outside Maastricht where one of the monuments officers is buried, a fellow named Walter Hutchhausen, one of two monuments officers killed during combat protecting works of art. The Castle of Neuschwanstein, another place that Harry Ettlinger and the Monuments Men were, where some 20,000 paintings stolen from the French collectors were found as a result of the secret information Rose Villain had gathered. People go to the Castle of Neuschwanstein and everything looks pretty hunky-dory and Disney-esque, but it was a very, very different scene. Years ago, really one of the key storage facilities. And we have many photographs from that experience in my first book, Rescuing Da Vinci. And you won't find it in the guidebooks there. Surprisingly, when you go today, you will not know about this part of the role that that castle played during World War II.
When you enjoy the art treasures of Europe today, let's close by just having you share which spot you're most moved and thankful for the work of these monuments men.
For me, it's not just a specific work of art. I mean, I certainly love to see that great painting by Leonardo da Vinci, the Czartoryski Lady with an Ermine in Krakow, out of a personal affection and Leonardo's great brilliance. But when I think about these monuments officers and what they went through, just surviving the war, surviving combat, for me, when I think about places such as Munich that had the Führerbau and one of the Nazi Party headquarters that stored so many of these works of art, to me, it's a remarkable achievement to think that these monuments officers stayed in Europe and worked in what was the Nazi Party headquarters and Hitler's own office there in Königsplatz, gathering these works of art and staying there, trying to sort out where they came from. And the irony, working in these the headquarters of evil during the war in Munich with all these works of art, trying to get them back. It's an incredibly heroic effort. It's an honor for me to represent them today through the work of the Monuments Men Foundation.
Robert Edsel, I'm really thankful for the work that you do to keep the mission of the Monuments Men alive and share it with our public. Robert Edsel, best wishes with your work, and thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Rick.
Ma petite amie chantait ses terres plein emprunt en arrivant au camp. Tous les petits poilus joyeux apprirent le refrain et bientôt tout le régiment entonna gaiement.
You'll find a roster of people from many nations who helped protect the art treasures of Europe during the Second World War, plus a list of those who continue their work today, including the U.S. Army's Monuments Officers Training Program. It's on the website for the Monuments Men and Women Foundation at monumentsmenandwomenfnd.org. We also have links to their work and to Robert Edsel's earlier appearances with us at ricksteves.com/radio. We'll hear how the hearty comfort foods of Belgium may have changed a bit over the years. But first, Fred Plotkin helps us search the overlooked corners of Italy for its homegrown culinary traditions. It's Travel with Rick Steves.